Episode 12 of Season 17. This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Mr. Miles Elam. Hi, Miles.
Hi, Lyle.
And Mr. Brian Young. Hello, Brian.
Hey, nice studio you got here.
We're actually recording from my son's bedroom because he's not here right now. And it's nice. And the drum kit's not here, so it's lots of space. Brian Young, you want to tell us about some cool software for DJs.
This story caught my eye because it's something as an iOS developer I've known about for almost a year now. Maybe, no, it's actually been almost 2 years now. Microsoft, in an effort to get more apps onto their mobile platform, and in fact all their platforms, made a library that allowed iOS developers to use the code that they wrote for iOS and port it over to the Windows, where they re-implemented a lot of the same underlying API calls.
Were they transcoding Swift or Objective-C, or are they...
Well, last I checked, it only worked with Objective-C, which is why I remember 2 years ago, because it was coming out at about the same time Swift was coming out.
Yeah, because making a transpiler for Swift would be a nightmare because it's already transpiling at some level.
It's not a transpiler. It's it's more like Wine, where they re-implemented the same API calls.
Yeah, but if they're writing it for Windows, they're not writing Objective-C. So there are API calls, but there's actually the syntax of the language, and something has to change the syntax of the language because Objective-C is Objective-C. There's no other language that's...
You can compile just about anything to go to a machine code as long as you have the right signature.
Oh, I see. So they just modified the compiler to compile off of libraries that they had made that had the same interface.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I think they are using Objective-C.
Cool.
So anyways, I've not seen any apps come out that are written in this. But here is one that was just announced on Windows Weekly, I think it's called. Oh, I'm sorry. No, Windows Central. So this article doesn't have a lot of details, but the app is called DJ Pro.
I've heard of that app on iOS.
A really popular app, and it's been around for years. It's won tons of awards. It's been recognized multiple times for user interface and performance.
I think when it first came out, it was shown at like WWDC as one of the example apps that takes advantage of all the things. So it's kind of like a really cool DJ interface, touch interface.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about this being the first app I've ever heard of that is actually ported over to Windows and is a high-profile app.
Oh, gosh, and you can run on the Surface Pro?
And you can run on the Surface
Pro.
In fact, they wrote it specifically for the Surface Pro. It doesn't work on the Windows mobile platform at the moment, but you can use it with the, what do you call the puck that you can attach to the screen?
The cool puck thing. Yeah, I don't know.
The cool puck thing. And they've designed it so depending on where the puck is, it serves different functions. It could be scratching the vinyl. It could be handling levels. It could be handling all sorts of other
crossfades.
So what this app does is this is for, obviously, DJs, for live mixing of music or throwing in effects and running your dance party, running anything. It's a highly performant app. It has to push audio through quickly, multiple tracks at the same time, and there can't be any delay. So it's very performance sensitive. So it is notable that they are announcing that it's released for Windows Mobile using what they call the Idlewood project, which allows them to use their original Objective-C code.
That's the project, Idlewood?
Right, Idlewood. So they can use their original Objective-C code over on Windows, and of course they do have to write some Windows code to
I'm sure there was quite a bit of development going on as well.
But the promise of this is that they can keep both the Windows and the iOS, and I believe there's a Mac version, I got to double check that, all at parity as they continue to develop and add features.
That's pretty cool. I'd be fascinated to see what the details were, you know, as a software engineer just really looking into it, because anytime you do something that's kind of like that, it's a lot of work normally. So
what you mean, like use JavaScript to make a desktop app?
Well, that's kind of being done. In fact, Windows, I remember when Windows 10 was first being touted before it was released, a big part of it is that you can run full native applications, you know, doing the whole UI in JavaScript. It's a standard part of the operating system. They've surfaced a lot to the JavaScript engine, which is pretty cool. But it's interesting that this isn't a JavaScript engine system. It's an Objective-C engine system.
No, and this is different from emulation. It's not using code that was compiled for some other platform and running it on a Intel CPU that when it was made for ARM or anything like that. This is compiling it over into... I hesitate to call it native code, but into code that runs natively.
Well, what you're describing is like WineLib.
Yeah,
The Wine is not an emulator, the acronym, what Wine stands for, but it's a re-implementation of the Windows calls, but they're not actually implementing those functions per se. They're just mapping the calls to a POSIX backend like Linux and filling in any gaps. Obviously, there's a lot of work. There's a lot of work behind that,
and that's gotten a lot easier on Windows 10 because Windows 10 has been doing enhancing that whole ability to run Linux kind of natively in Windows. So Wine basically has been power boosted, if you will, by Microsoft. Is that a good way of talking about it? You can run Linux stuff natively in Windows 10 now, as like a side channel operating system thing.
The thing behind Wine that I always knew about was being able to run Windows stuff on Linux,
right?
The other way. So
sure. Sorry. Yeah. Miscommunication. That sounds awesome. And that it's a performant app, that it's an audio-based app that has to have a lot of channels, a lot of things queued, that means that they're doing the things that are important correctly.
Well, I mean, I'm suspicious on how well this thing actually works, but it is an app that has to be performant. There's no way it's going to get recognition or get anywhere if it doesn't live up to the basic expectations.
Speaking of Windows 10, I had a buddy, when they talked about being able to run Linux stuff more easily in Windows, I had a buddy at work that decided to get a Windows laptop. It was right when I got my MacBook Pro that has the Touch Bar. And so he's like, oh, look, I've got ports on mine. You know, he's been teasing me a bit. And about 3 or 4 days after he got it, like over the weekend, I came over to him and was like, oh, so you're just like, it looks like you're running Linux. He's like, yeah, I am running Linux. He's dual booting. He couldn't get Windows 10 to kind of be as much like Linux as he wanted, or as much of the POSIX system as he wanted. So he switched to running dual boot. He has got a great laptop, though, really nice performance, using, I think, Ubuntu all the time, and then switching to Windows when he wants to do VR stuff. Anyway, so Windows 10 is not necessarily ready for prime time, but I got to say the hardware looks pretty compelling. Yeah. When I sit here setting up audio setup with you guys to do this recording, I have no USB ports. I have no audio in. I give stuff to you, Miles, and you just plugged everything in.
We have USB ports, just not USB-A.
Yeah.
USB-C.
USB useless. USB dongle is what I've got.
For the next 2 years.
Yeah.
USB screwed legacy.
Let's go on to Ubuntu, actually. That's my story. Hey, look at that. So Ubuntu Unity is the visual UI for Ubuntu. And Unity, I remember when it first came out, Miles, you were really excited, like, this is usable by anybody. Like, you can use this operating system.
I said that?
Yeah, you were all touting it.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah, you were high. So
I don't remember that at all.
Maybe it was more like, look at how great and easy Ubuntu is. Even with this Unity interface, it looks and feels so much like a contemporary operating system.
That Ubuntu is pretty easy to use
And at some point, maybe it could like take over and be people, you know, my aunt could use this, no problem. Well, in any case.
I don't remember taking over, but I do remember my aunt could probably use this.
Yeah. So Canonical is the makers of Ubuntu. Recently, and specifically of this interface that they're actually getting rid of. So Unity is going to be shut down and killed completely, and they're going to step back as the default using GNOME, which is, what does GNOME stand for? GNU. GNU is, oh, that's the other
one. Oh, no, I used to know this, but it's desktop environment, whatever.
Anyway, the GNU environment is kind of the Windows environment for Linux in general, or it's not exactly associated with Linux, but it's what you normally run, unless you were running Ubuntu's Unity. So
now the question is, why did they do this?
Why do you think they did it?
I'm pretty sure I know why.
Tell me.
Unity was supposed to be an API that handled everything that you were writing for phones, for tablets, for desktops, for laptops with touchscreens or not, and Ubuntu got absolutely no headway in terms of phones and tablets.
Well, but I got to say that though Unity 8 was shipping on phones and tablets, it wasn't ever stable enough for the desktop. So Unity 7 was. So there was a kind of a discontinuity Unity.
Yeah, except for the fact that...
But yeah, how many people, no one's using it.
Yeah, how many people do you know have a Ubuntu phone?
Yeah, it's totally not working from that perspective.
And so there it becomes just a headache. They have to support this separate infrastructure, when everyone else is using a competing technology, whether that be right. GNOME or it be Qt.
Right. So they're effectively going to stop all mobile development, and with that, stopping the Unity development, but continue making desktop.
Right. Or server, which is how I
Yeah, the better way to think about it. Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
Because a lot of folks who did not like Unity and did not like the direction that Ubuntu was taking went to, for example, Linux Mint, which was also Ubuntu, but they were using GNOME.
GNOME, yeah. And I got to say, when I was first like trying to move over to the operating system, leaving a Windows environment, trying to switch over to a Linux environment, I was using Ubuntu and installing and deciding which one to install. And then I'd find software packages I want to use, audio software packages, and try to learn them, and they would be GNU interfaces. So now I'd be running two, which doesn't really work, and so you'd be switching around. It was kind of complicated and frustrating. So I can see the – I'm not surprised it's going away and making it simpler for everybody. Let's tell me about Linux development, though, Miles.
Yeah, speaking of Linux, there is a thing called a Gorse video. And Gorse is something that we've talked about in the past.
When did we talk about that, Brian?
We talked about that back in 2016, January 2016, a little over a year ago. We were talking about the development of the Swift language when they open sourced that. And long before you could actually see the code, you could when they had just released it, they had the entire history of the Swift project going back 5 years before you could actually use it, and you got to see the Gorse video of how it developed.
Okay, so Miles, describe, and you can go watch that.
So here, it's a Gorse video of Linux kernel development, which is a much longer-lived period of time, and also much larger in scope, I dare say.
Vastly.
So you're talking about from 1991 to 2012.
Whoa.
Now, they are also including the CVS updates, because Linux kernel was on CVS, not Git, for a long time. So you're watching that for a while, and that's where a lot of the development, early development happened.
Okay, so as people were developing the Linux operating system, they were using a source control system called Subversion, which is no longer...
CVS.
CVS, excuse me. CVS, I can't remember
that. Concurrent versioning system.
Right, which is a... an older type style of source management control.
Well, it was actually innovative at the time.
Yeah, totally.
Because
compared to RC?
It used to be you locked a file and you edited it, and then you put the updated one in there and you took a lock away. So people couldn't use the same file at the same time. Your concurrent versioning system, although it wasn't the first one of its type, it was open source, and so therefore the biggest and most popular of this. Allowed multiple people to work on the same file at the same time as long as they weren't working on the same part of the file.
Right.
And then if you did have a conflict, then you could
work together to
merge that fairly simply.
That experience of developing Linux in CVS and over time, its faults and stuff upset Linus Torvalds, who's actually created Linux, much that he actually created Git.
There was actually an interim, which was BitKeeper.
That
was what convinced Linus Torvalds of the different model and other developers.
Which is distributed source control, where you don't have an authoritative.
There is no central server, yeah.
So all the history going back through all Linux development time is visualized in this kind of Gorse video, which is like a graph of like a social node structure.
Right. So you see the different pieces, different branches, and different directories popping off of it. And then you also see the contributors. An individual person would pop in, make some change, and then fade away. Another one pop, and you'd see the same names pop in over and over again. And the whole tree is just it's
quite
growing.
Dynamic.
It's quite organic.
Yeah,
it looks like something growing and moving and.
And of course, I can't think of a more organic project than Linux itself.
Yeah.
Well, I think of technology in terms of programming. We think of that as a very analytical, logical structure. But when you go back a level and you talk about the contributions and the collaboration of thousands of people, then it becomes a much more organic structure. Then it becomes a lot more fluid.
Yeah.
Well, fundamentally, it's being run by people, and we just aren't that much of a computer ourselves.
As much as we'd like to pretend that we are.
So I definitely recommend watch that video. The thing that shocked me about that video is that as I started it, when you shared it with us earlier this week, I started watching it, and I thought it was going to end soon.
No.
And I'm watching for a few minutes, and I'm like, what date are we? And I finally saw the date. I'm like, wait, how far does this go? And then I scrolled over the video so the playhead came along, and I was like tenth of the way through. I'm like, oh my gosh.
If you were a couple of minutes, you were way less than a tenth.
It is a long thing. Pretty cool. I'm also curious how, like, it was fascinating. It's fascinating to watch giant new chunks of code emerge quickly.
Yep.
And then kind of get reduced or moved around. It's neat to be able to see that. I'm curious what those big chunks are. Like, someone brings in some kind of library and then it gets yanked out. I mean, really fascinating stuff, though. So, neat video.
Well, different pieces will come in and then supplant older ones, which then go in a bit rotten and are pruned. But yeah.
The episode where, Brian, that you brought up, the Swift visualization was the January 2nd of 2016. It's Perl's first stage of net neutrality is Swift. That was the title that probably Greg named it. And I have to say that the way I was able to find that was a little unknown trick using Google. In Google's search bar, anytime you have Google and you're searching for words, you can reduce the search to a specific site by just using the word site, colon, and then the domain name. So I just did site, colon, geekspeak.org, and then search for whatever you want. You can do that with all domains, and it's kind of a neat feature. It's also available to you if you click the advanced search features in Google, and you can step through and use a web form for it. But you can always just add site, colon, and then whatever the site is. Brian, talk to us about... Oh, actually, it's Miles' turn first. In a second, Brian's going to tell us all about Siri and a joke, and I'm curious about that. But first, garage door openers?
Internet of Things, kind of big right now.
Oh, yeah.
Including someone who wanted to be able to open and close their garage door via Wi-Fi. Garage door, it's a thing. Therefore, sure. Connected to the Internet. Internet of Things.
I'm sure there's one of those. Wait, haven't like garage door openers been around a long time? They've always been wireless? You want to do it via his phone?
Having knowledge of like when it opened and closed.
So you can log that information.
Doing stuff like that, yeah.
And then if you drive away and go, wait, did I close the garage door? You can check on your phone.
Right, so he had a problem with it. And so he left an angry comment on the community board because it's just basically one guy behind this gadget called GarageIt. And
some angry comment on a message board? Wow,
right.
When has that ever happened before?
Right. Having not received a response, he left a 1-star review on Amazon. A very scathing comment, you know, junk, don't waste your money, that the type of
sure.
rant that
we've seen those.
We've seen those, yeah. So the person behind the product responded by saying, sorry, we don't allow abusive language here and don't like your negative comments, so I'm going to cut off your access to the server. And without server access... it doesn't work anymore.
I was trying to figure out what the story is if he just deleted the guy or banned the guy from the message board. But he just turned off his garage door. So he can no longer get in to open his garage door anymore.
With his product, yeah. You'd have to replace it.
That's pretty awesome.
Well, that's the thing, though, is
I mean,
when you purchase a garage door opener and
you're not expecting online social interaction to be important.
Right. But in addition to that, that notion of it feels almost as if we don't own the things that we have purchased anymore. We're used to, you buy a front door, you've got a front door. You know, like, and you, if you say, this is a crap front door, the manufacturer doesn't then go, well, we're taking this door back, you know, or
no,
we're taking axe to it.
You get to keep the door. You just can't open it.
Right. The hinges are now frozen. So, first off, of course, the person that the service of doing that because of a customer complaint blocking from the server is a really interesting side effect, right? Because in one way, a very standard practice if you're abusive on online communities is to be banned from their forum. So one way to think about this is that the sysadmins were like, oh, this person shouldn't be involved anymore in our forum, so block his IP.
Yeah.
And that might have also affected the server that ran.
No, it
probably
wasn't.
Doesn't.
It was
probably completely
yeah.
separate. But that aspect makes a lot of sense. So then when you're talking about the service that you've paid for, additionally, when you pay for an IoT device, you're paying for the device, and then the fine print normally does not enforce some kind of service agreement, because of course the company's writing it and they want to protect themselves. Now they're not going to sell units if everybody's systems don't work anymore, but there's not a real flaw for them to cancel this one person, except for the bad press, of course, that they're going to get.
I think the funny thing is the reason why they did this is they didn't want the bad comments online. They didn't want the bad press in the first place.
It's ridiculous. It's like obviously going to be making headlines. It's an interesting idea, right? Some company gets the guys locked out of his garage.
Well, no one really knows what's going to happen. There are some times where
they'll turn it back on.
Yeah, people get screwed over and you don't hear about it. Right. And other times where a mild slight comes over and it blows up and everyone's talking about it. So this is an area, though, that is really interesting, though. Like, what is, because we have the Internet thing, because we don't have those contracts nailed down, there isn't a normal code of conduct that we can say that is normal.
Right. Yeah, there isn't anything normal. That's true. It's all an unknown.
There's
space.
No such thing as a norm if you don't have any data to work off of.
Well, I mean, we have norms that we think are analogous.
We have social norms, but they don't really apply when you start changing the model.
But we've had service agreements with companies for a long time. Like, I have Comcast as my network connection, right? That's how we're streaming right now and dealing with things online. And I talk about them bad all the time. I hate that company. I pay them a lot of money, and they don't care that I talk about them badly, but
because you don't have a choice.
I don't have a choice because there's almost, and we'll get to that in a little bit. There's actually no competition in this market. But in any case, the idea that they might go, oh, that customer is speaking badly of us. Okay, you don't get our service anymore. Comcast is not going to do that, right? They don't. That's not how they're.
There's
they
no anti disparagement clause.
But a little tiny, you know, a little company where the person made their service themselves. I don't know. I kind of like the idea of somebody deciding that guy's a jerk. I'm turning off the service. It feels more honest than a corporate overlord that's just doing it by the books.
But isn't the story really that IoT is so not thought out that your forum and your forum account is connected to the account that controls?
I don't think it is. But you're right. It could be.
No, it's a separate thing. And the person who owns the who sold the garage information has come across the Streisand effect. He recognized like it was kind of a dumb move. It was an overreach. At the same time, he was saying he didn't think that people should be abusive online, which is true. We should be nicer to each other online, just in general.
And blocking that one person from getting into his garage will definitely help that situation,
right? But that
won't make him irate at all.
But no. That was absolutely an overreach. Say like, oh yeah, this person is being abusive, they don't like the products. Like, that's where as a business owner you say, sorry you don't like the product, here's your money back, or you know, we ban you from the forums, but you know, if you say you want it back, that's fine.
Right.
You deal with it, but you don't just do the worst of both worlds. Yeah. Which is say, you have the product and you gave me money, but I'm not actually going to provide the service that they were expecting when you pay when they gave you that money.
And in a second, Miles, and after Brian's story, Miles is going to talk a little bit more about something else being, well, this is more about being hacked rather than being service turned off. But first,
before you get off this story, though, this whole idea of wanting to have control over the services that I use, that led me to run an email server for like 10 years. And my web server, my email server, a bunch of other services off my computer. Do you know how much of my life I gave to managing spam and that email server in that?
Yeah, Miles and I did it for years.
You didn't know about gray listing, did you?
Did you do gray listing?
Oh, no, I had a ton of different things. I had gray listing. I had Spam Assassin. I had some proc mail scripts that were overloaded. But it just took like a half an hour of my day every single day.
Didn't spend that much time. We just ended up with like spam filled email for a long period of time. And then I turned on gray listing. We have the episode. We have to look it up sometime. Man, this was 10 magic. Years ago or more than 10 years ago. Who knows? And it was like flipping off a switch. It was email accounts that some of us were saying, I'm just going to give up on it because I can't use it anymore. It's just too much in there. Suddenly he's like, oh, wow, there's actually useful emails in there. Wow, this is great.
The episode was called Spam Fighting, Gray Listing. I obviously titled that one. There's a punctuation in the title. It was July 1st, 2005, and we had Evan Harris on. He was the author of The Next Step in Spam Control, War, Gray Listing. Joins the Geeks for a discussion on fighting spam. Geeks Sean, Miles, Drew, and host Lyle.
2005?
Yeah, 12 years ago.
Yeah, I was giving up at about 1 year later.
Yeah.
Anyway. Hey, that server lasted quite a while. We actually had that set up.
You can learn about how spam, how gray listing works by going and listen to that episode. We're not going to get into it now. All right, so do you have a story about Siri?
So I just said to Siri, surely it won't rain today. And she said, it will. And don't call me Shirley. I'd forgotten to turn off the airplane mode. I know. Okay. So I couldn't pull that one off. But the whole reason why I bring up Siri tonight is because on the way over here, I remembered about at least two or three different incidents where we said, we're going to record over at Lyle's house. And Lyle says, when we get up into the valley, that, oh no, I left the microphones back at work. So I said, okay, while I'm driving here, I'm going to send Lyle a quick message.
Yes.
This quick message lasted for at least 5 miles. 15 different times did I try to say, send a message to Lyle.
Oh yeah, that was safe.
No, absolutely. I've got 4 lanes of traffic that I'm going through. I'm changing lanes.
And what was the phrasing that she couldn't get?
Mic kit.
Why didn't you use the word microphone?
I tried microphone, but then I hesitated and it came out microphone. And sometimes it wasn't even micro. So I tried this so many times. I couldn't believe that. I just could not get mic kit. And I got all sorts of words that I can't even say on our show. But I'm going
to
try this again.
Here's the one that you finally got to me.
Okay.
You want to read that? Or are you going to try doing that?
Well, I just want to try this because there is a possibility it was the microphone that is in my Bluetooth.
Brian's going to use a control word. Well, you know what I'll do is I'll just...
No. My phone doesn't do the control word. Send a message to Lyle. Hey, Lyle. Hey, it's not working. Hey, Lyle, remember to bring the mic kit with you. It says make it. It just cannot do it.
You finally were able to say, hey there, I was just thinking that maybe I should remind you to bring the microphone back with you tonight. So you never said kit. That's good.
And that was supposed to be bag.
And then you said, I'm driving right now, and it took me about 15 minutes to, to get through.
And the moral to the story is, pull over.
I pull over.
Stop the vehicle.
I pull over
so
much. I'm so glad that most of my commute is actually not on freeways because I pull over all the time. My phone chims. I'm like, it might be something important. I pull over and look at it.
But here's the thing. All it needs to do is when you say that word and then it sends you the message, it just has to send you the recording. All you need is the recording.
Why
with,
you just,
with the
can't
bad
you send
translation.
A recording? You can't send a recording through voice commands with her. With it.
I haven't figured out those commands.
And we got this as a slight tangent, just to be clear, you have all these companies making hands-free kits for your car and the audio manufacturers making hands-free available for these things. The stats say this isn't making us any safer.
Yeah, hands-free versus holding your hand is the same amount of safety.
Right.
Or lack thereof.
And really, pull over.
I got to say, I really like having an 11-year-old, though, because when I'm driving, I can just hand her the phone, and she'll send the text messages. It's awesome.
No, that's the way to go. Definitely.
Have kids so they can
have
do
children,
stuff for you.
Make sure they don't grow past 12 so they don't get uninterested in everything you say.
And hope the self-driving cars get worked out by the time they can drive.
Fabrizio actually tweeted with us recently saying, let's see. Do you know, Lyle, do you know the magic words to get the Amazon Echo to play the correct geek speak? And so I was like, I started typing back, yeah, no problem, you just do this. Because when the Amazon Echo first launched and I used it, I connected TuneIn and I just said, play geek speak. And it just played our show. And I was like, that's so cool. Like, it was really easy. And then everybody else started using the Google connection device, including Comic Geek Speak, which is a really cool podcast about comics. And they just have the word comic geek speak, but they have 3 words. They use geek and speak with a space. So I tried to get my Echo to actually recognize just playing our show. I couldn't do it. Now, granted, it could be that we concatenate the word. So it's one word, geek speak.
Is that how you have to say
but
it?
It also could be the title right now because of iTunes' horrible searching algorithms. I wanted to make sure to get the word geek in our title. And so the title right now is geek speak, one word. With a pipe character. See? I love punctuation in titles. Geek Speak, how technology affects society and culture from the geek perspective. Which I kept on trying to say to the Echo, because I thought it'd be funny to respond back with, all you have to say is this like sentence and a half. It can't get that either. So we're changing the name of the show.
That's all you can do.
That's all we're doing. So
it'll
anyway,
still say Geek Speak, but there'll be more to it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that the pull request I have right now that you guys need to approve is geek space speak. So it's actually 2 words, which it used to be that way, and it shifted over time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When we first started, it was geek space speak. Yeah,
we didn't know what we were doing back then. It was
I always wanted it to be one word, and then I think that Sean was doing the marketing for us for a while, and that became geek speak with a space in it. And then it deviated back, I think, when we got the logo that we currently have. Anyway, with Lyle Troxell, so there's a uniqueness in it. You don't have to, like, figure out what the show title is. You just remember me.
Wouldn't the geek thing to do to put an underscore between it?
I should probably put a punctuation in there. You can do that. You can do a change of pull request. Do a suggestion. Let's move on with the show, though, since we've been navel gazing for too long. Someone did something bad in Dallas.
Yes, Dallas has warnings for when there's a tornado coming by, as many cities do in the South, or in what could be construed as tornado country. It is technically part of Tornado Alley.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, apparently they were internet connected, because someone set the sirens off, all of them.
Wait, in all of Dallas?
In all of Dallas.
That's not a good thing.
No, this is not funny.
Very early in the morning.
Oh, no.
Wait, what time was it?
Wait, so they got control of these things and set off the alarms for the entire city. This is fire alarms. What kind of alarm is this? Fire alarm?
No, these are...
It's an emergency alarm.
These are like what you would expect from like an air raid warning.
Oh, my
these are
God.
Sirens.
For all of Dallas? Just
yeah.
They went off.
Yeah.
Okay, that's yeah. Horrific. And I mean, we lived in a floodplain, and we had to test that every once in a while. And mm-hmm. I remember one time I was near it without remembering it was test day. We tested like on the first Monday of every or whatever. And those things are loud and shocking. But for a whole city to go off, you'd have to assume something horrible is happening. And when did this happen? After the Syrian attack?
Yes. The Syrian attack had happened.
So you're already thinking about war potentials. So and, oh, man.
Friday night, we're recording on a Monday. You're hearing this on Wednesday. So the previous Friday, 18 minutes before midnight, 156 weather sirens go off.
Oh, man.
And continue to go off for, you know, to the terror of 1.3 million residents. Well past, what is it here, 1:30 a.m.? I mean, non-true amount of time. They just keep going and they don't know how to turn it off. Now, one of the things that's been going on is you have, for example, the mayor saying that it's an attack on our emergency notification system, and wants to prosecute we will identify and prosecute those responsible. And yet, I see this story and I immediately think of, why is this even available on the internet for a hacker to get to?
They obviously did not watch Battlestar Galactica.
But, I mean, this is along the lines of something that we were talking about before the show, which is we tend to think of, and especially because of TV and Hollywood, that hackers, you know, this brilliant misanthrope will, do a Thor's hammer to your computer security, no matter what precautions you take, and get in. And that's not how it works. It's not like where you have a tank and you try to put as much armor on it as possible, but there's still going to be some missile that can penetrate it.
You're saying it's not like the physical world in that you can just keep on banging at something.
Right.
In the digital world, it's different.
Right. And so there are bad attacks. There are like distributed denial of service attacks. But in general, the defenses are stronger than the attacks. The attacks have to be so nuanced and so specific to get into modern systems when they are configured intelligently.
It's interesting because the denial of service attack you're talking about is actually more like a physical attack in the sense that you are overwhelming the system like you would with brute force mm-hmm. in a tank situation, right? You're overwhelming the abilities. That's what you're doing. You're
right.
Attacking. But in most hacking situations, especially like taking over, you are seizing control. You're looking for the nuance to break in. But at the same time, Miles, I get why people think that it's just about brute force. Because for years on this program, we've been talking about how a targeted attack is like, it's so hard to defend from that, right?
Yes.
Because there are so many different vulnerabilities that if you get smart people looking at it, eventually they get into the DNC computers. Well, like, that's just what happens.
Except you're talking about a state-sponsored attack, or assumed to be a state-sponsored attack. You're talking about a lot of resources to try to essentially do a phishing email
right.
to get into someone's account. And that was the security of the system wasn't the problem. It's the people involved that allow those hacks. And that's where most hacks are, social engineering.
But you're right that the nuance, like, it is easier to defend. Like, I I feel relatively safe with my network security system at this house. It's not like someone can just bang at it, right? It's got a front firewall, and that thing's probably pretty good. Like, I'm not really mm-hmm. concerned that they can get into my network because yeah. you can't really, right?
Or to make a cultural reference, the show iRobot, it shows him, like, oh, I took a look in his Gmail, and I looked around. It's pure fantasy.
Yeah, you can't get into someone's Gmail.
That just doesn't happen, because if that could happen, every dissident in the world who gets under the skin of a dictator that is on Gmail would be dead already.
Right.
If that were the case.
So it is true that there is more secure. I mean, security is actually easier in some ways. In fact, one of the side effects of seeing the leaks we've been seeing of the CIA recently is that, yeah, encryption was really good. That's actually not what they're breaking. Yeah, which is kind of neat. So in this story, yeah, go on.
So when you say identify and prosecute those responsible, that's great, except this is critical infrastructure. And this is something that people don't necessarily like to talk about as much. A lot of municipal infrastructure is not actually secure, not because we can't secure systems, but because it's not as convenient.
Right. Well, let's talk about these sirens for a second. I mean, just imagine like you were tasked for just like Santa Cruz City to put in like 15 sirens, whatever. So it's a small situation, but you'd have mm-hmm. to connect these somehow, and you'd have to trigger them and be able to trigger them effectively. You want to trigger all of them. It's a coastal community, so you'd want to be able to trigger all of them in the case of some storm situations. Mm-hmm. So how would you connect those? What would you do as a municipality in a small city?
That's the thing where... Okay, that's a complex conversation.
It is a complex question, but that's the thing. The thing to do is to connect them up to a network, right?
Yeah, no, but I mean, like, I could describe it. It's just that it would be longer than we want to spend
on air right now. My point is that you're going to make a network for them. You have to. So what kind of network are you going to use? Well, you're going to use Ethernet because that's the way you do it. And are you going to run direct cable to all of them? Well, no, that would be crazy because you already have cable everywhere. So you just take advantage of other networks that already exist. They're going to be on the internet. Like, yes, it's true that you'd want a subnet. You'd want to segregate them and all that. But the truth is that some of those pathways are going to be through AT&T, and that's just how it's going
to
be.
Like, yes, but still getting access to those systems is a separate problem. And making it so that someone could just have access to all of them all at once, who shouldn't have credentials, somebody messed up. Somebody messed up.
The thing
big.
Is, the person responsible is the IT people that did that, right? I mean, they're or the
well, the IT people,
or the person that bought the software from some vendor. Like, there are so many people that are responsible for that problem.
Speaking as someone who has worked in large corporations before, I'm pretty sure that a lot of IT departments, especially municipal IT departments, are actually very good. What happens is the random employee that works for the municipality. That decides that it's okay to take their work laptop home and connect up in a coffee shop that has the database of all social security numbers.
Sure.
Or the person that decides that they're going to put a post-it note for it, or they're going to use the password.
Well, IT should stop that. I mean, IT should stop that.
Yes. But I mean, it's still that notion of the weak link is almost always a human being, not the computer system.
I was talking to an IT expert that works in Silicon Valley, and the job that he does is creates algorithms to detect anomalies, kind of what I think Alex Slias does this as mm-hmm. well, in that the systems are so complex in these big organizations that the best thing you can do is actually have pattern recognition systems that detect something that's unusual and then act upon it.
See what normal is first.
Yeah. And I didn't even know that my office has these things in place. And so I logged into a system recently that I had never logged into before because I was looking up some title information. As a UI engineer at Netflix, you interact with a lot of the systems because you have to do – someone asks like, well, what string are you using there? And I had to go look into a back system and figure that out. And in doing that, it was just in a meeting. I'm just like doing it. Everyone has access, good access to things. About 4 hours later, I get an email from IT saying, you know, your account was used to access this system you've never accessed it before. Is this an anomaly? And they just wanted information about it. And so I was like, yep, this is unusual. It is unusual that I did that. That's correct. But it was really neat to see that kind of effect because it does make sense. If my credentials had been taken, I'm going to – that person that takes my credentials is going to look different than me from a fingerprint perspective.
Yeah. From a public policy standpoint, when we talk about infrastructure, cybersecurity definitely needs to go into this because we talk about – you know, $80 million spent on an airstrike and on an airfield in Syria recently. And at the same time, here we were able to turn on these emergency sirens for an extended period of time. What happens if there's something that isn't just a annoyance or frightening, but actually dangerous?
That is very dangerous.
Well, I was going to say, I think you're underselling what actually happened.
Well, I'm talking about like if you were able to cut power to an area, I think that would be...
The article doesn't go into this, but it's very possible that somebody's life was lost because of this event.
Sure.
911 was completely overloaded by all the calls related to what people thought was a serious alarm.
Yeah, so a heart attack that might have been, you know, might have been protected, might have person might have survived, might not have survived because of this event. Of course, exactly. It's hard to know those kind of things at that kind of scale.
Right.
But more than that, you're also... you're reducing the trust in the system. So next time there is an emergency and it is supposed to be used, there'll be some people that won't act. And so that level also causes damage. I agree, Miles, though, that it is a resource allocation problem in a large sense as well.
Well, yeah. And where you allocate your resources should be dependent on what the risk is for the system failing. Mm-hmm. And this one is high enough that it definitely should have been a lot better.
I got to say this is one of those things where, you know, you hear a lot about, well, hackers are bad and all that. And then you have security researchers, people that are basically hacking, but they're doing it as a research paradigm where they get incentives to potentially find faults. And then they deliver those faults and then they get money back. And Google does this and Apple does this and like lots of
companies
do this. In the
private sector it happens, yes. Not necessarily the public. Yeah.
But obviously this is a situation that it would have been great if someone had found this and got some reward, even some acknowledgement maybe is all they needed. And nothing bad happened except they were able to fix the flaw rather than getting the acknowledged and reward for causing the alarms to go off, right? It does make sense to go ahead and power some people at some level to investigate rather than cause havoc.
Right.
But I would say that most people, especially in the public sector, don't understand that concept.
And there are stories in the past about people doing this kind of research and then being prosecuted based on the fact that, yes, they did break the law in order to find these flaws that they tried to alert people to.
Yeah, there is the desire that I see from a lot of people saying we need to get systems that will, you know, seek out the hackers or to – there's also that thing of we can't have privacy because we need to know where the bad people are.
That's insane.
Right. No, but I mean that's the narrative that we hear often. Yeah. And really, if you spent a tenth of that money that you would spend to go, like, we need to find those people and prosecute them, to actually doing a real audit of our system to just use best practices, to say, why is the person bringing their laptop home? Because they have this pain point. Well, let's just maybe we could fix that. Maybe we could put some patches in there. Maybe we could change the way that we do access remotely so that it wouldn't be a problem. But that is a lot more boring. Yeah. It's a lot harder to sell that because real security is boring.
Yeah. It's interesting. We have two-factor authentication stuff. It's kind of a standard thing now. And the way that it works with the system, it is true that if I don't have my phone, I can't log into work, right? Like that's a true thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think I can call IT and give them information to potentially to get around that. But basically, I've got to have my phone because that's got the two-factor authentication. But the way the system works, though it's a little annoying, is pretty nice. I can make the password be what I want. No one else knows my password. The password is, it's complex, but it's not that bad. But there's a second layer of having the phone. And of course, the phone has my thumbprint on it. Like all these things, it is a little more annoying to sign on. But every time I do VPN in and I connect to the network and everything, and I do those steps, it's kind of a reassuring thing knowing that I'm the only one doing that. Like, and it's not that it's the system's good enough that it's not frustrating. So there is a level where we can get to that point. I wish I had that kind of system for my bank and for my, for other things in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Gmail actually isn't even as good as the one that I'm using for work because I've got it triggers a push notification and it goes to my phone and then I can just push a button on my phone, which is nice. Instead of the having to type in 6 characters as well, which is what sometimes I have to do that for Google as well. But in any case, it is true that it's annoyance, but when it's done right, it's not that bad. And the security is worth it.
Yeah. One of the things I saw about public procurement with government is that the way that they do it in terms of here are all the regulations that we have for security, and those can be useful. They are also wasteful because you can't know ahead of time all the problems that you may have. And it sometimes puts you in a bind and it slows you down. And one of the things you can't B, with regard to security, is too slow. That'll kill you. Yeah. And so that was one of the problems that they had with regard to, I don't believe it was data.gov, but trying to get healthcare.gov up and running was the rules and regulations for how you did equipment allocation and how you built up the software was contrary to modern software development practices that are done in the industry. And those two need to be reconciled somehow. Sure.
All right. Well, thank you for that story about the tornado in Dallas. It's so funny that my first reaction was, it's funny. My second reaction is how horrifying it is. So it's nice to talk through that a little bit more. I appreciate the conversation. Brian, you want to talk about some tech in markets?
Some tech. you threw me off there. Yeah. No, this is about tech, but there was a article. It's about a month old now, but I wanted to bring it up because for anybody who is a geek and loving to use some of the great services, sites, and apps that are out there nowadays, there's an extra layer to think about. So Anil Dash writes an article outlining basically how markets have been distorted over the years. He outlines how in the beginning of the internet, it was very much a free market idea of, look, there's Google where it's indexing all of the internet, and there is a real free market of ideas on how something gets bubbled up to the top of a search. If it gets more links in there, it's more valuable.
Who's Neil Dash?
Well,
Anil.
Anil.
I'm sorry. He's a tech writer that has been around for... He's been around for a while, and... I know him through a number of podcasts and shows where he is usually writing some thoughtful pieces.
Yeah, he is a tech CEO of Fog Creek Software, who is a strong advocate of diversity, of inclusion, of progressive values in general, and trying to put forth those values within the tech industry.
All right.
Trying to... make changes to that tech industry on a social level, not as much the technical level.
Okay, so what's this article saying that it originally was a free market idea, and early web, of course, didn't have Google; it had Alta Vista. But
yes.
But
there was space for Google to come up because it was very much an open market on whatever service fit your needs. But in this article, he outlines how things have changed over the years. Of course, Google search results got gamed. People tried to do SEO and try to bubble up to the top through not necessarily the means that would reflect whether you should be at the top of the search, and this affected how Google ran the search engine and how that market of searches would work. And back at this time, you know, eBay in the early days, it was a straightforward idea of, I'm going to sell my my little figurines that I've had in my closet for 10 years and put it up there. And it was a straight auction where the best price would win. Mm-hmm. But then you go forward and things start getting rigged. So when Google had to deal with the SEO problem, it had to make the rules less visible. It had to make sure that the rules can't just be figured out from the outside where somebody could game the system. And it became an arms race of rigging how... search results work versus what people put into the system.
So basically, like, now how the algorithm actually works, we have general ideas how the search engine system works, but in reality on top of that is this kind of subversion fighting level that's basically just trying to stop people from gaming the system.
Exactly.
And so there's a secret level that's there as well.
Yeah.
And the result being that now it's an arms race among very large companies that have the resources to be able to do that SEO work, and a lot of other folks are kind of left out, and has kind of tipped the scales in the favor of the big business yet again.
Side effects hitting all walks of life, like the election, is probably very much influenced by people taking advantage of the systems that exist for the purpose of spreading information through social media and stuff. By the way, lately I've been very cautious of what people are requesting account access to me via Facebook and befriending, you know? I'm getting a lot of requests to be befriended on Facebook by individuals that have had short-lived accounts or only have one connection and everything. These are bots, right?
Yeah.
They're clearly bots. And it's funny because most of the stuff I post on Facebook is public anyway, so it's not like I need them. Like, I don't really necessarily want them. But the information of who is in my network, of course, those bots would like. And I don't know, it's just kind of a sideline of this, but go on.
Oh, well, so what the meat of this article is about, it comes back to one of our favorite companies to talk about lately is Uber. So Anil's whole premise is that now we're in an age where markets are completely fake. Uber is set up around this idea where they use the terms of entrepreneurship for their drivers, and yet the drivers don't control what the price that they're charging is. It's completely controlled by a closed system that Uber controls. In fact, Uber is known for distorting that market. They're known for showing cars on the map that don't actually exist in order to distort what the value of that ride is, or what people can expect when they look at the app.
Wow.
And that goes so far as in Uber's business model. Currently, they are underselling their services by estimated about a half. I mean,
they're losing money.
Money on every ride, and they're being funded by their VC stakeholders. So these kind of distorted fake markets are something that we're buying into. We see extreme value in just using an Uber, using a Lyft to get a ride and get around, but it can't last. It's fundamentally a flawed market that will in some day affect us socially, affect us economically when it has to balance itself out.
Hmm.
And we were talking about before the show, this also can be found in both AMP and even more so in the Facebook news platform.
AMP is the mobile fast app thing we were talking about last week with Google, where Google provides a way of making your web pages a lot faster and helps host some of the files, and also a protocol that makes it a lot quicker to deliver stuff. And how are those markets like that? And Facebook, of course, is Facebook Fast, which is basically ads on Facebook that are served by Facebook and cached to your phone even if you don't want them.
Facebook Instant Articles.
Thanks.
So here, Facebook and to some extent Google AMP are offering a market for news, mm-hmm. for publishers, a new avenue for publishers to publish their works. But the market, once again, the rules are hidden from the publishers on what is promoted and how people are going to find those.
And how much money it's going to cost is completely up to Facebook, even if they say it's an auction. Reality, right. It's their algorithm.
Where publishers lose the whatever control over advertising, sure. they had outside of that system.
At the same time, a publisher that doesn't partake in that just doesn't get the readership.
Right.
So what are you going to do?
So there's a real value to the reader as well, because they're getting their news in a form that's so much more user-friendly than a junked-up web page with a million JavaScript bits on it. So,
and, my iPhone has the operating system. Apple actually pushes in news feeds, and it's by like five or six different news vendors. I think you can hone it and choose it and all that. But the default ones are winning. Like, that's how I mostly hear about the most up-to-date. If I'm not on Twitter for a while, that's what I'm hearing about from the most up-to-date news stories is through those news sources that Apple decided was going to be on my phone.
Right. So this was a plea, because there's really no ready-made solution to fix this.
What's his plea then?
The plea is that we, the users, actually think about what we are buying into when we start using these services, and that the people in these companies who are very possibly thinking that they're doing great work because it does bring value to the public at first. Actually, think about the system that you're creating. Think about the implications down the road. If you're building a system that has to be undercut in price just to start up in the business, is it going to provide real value when the actual money needed to make it run is withdrawn from the customers? Or are people able to actually see how the algorithms work enough that the market is using real market forces, or whether it's being controlled by some corporate entity that has other motivations?
This strikes me as a very similar pattern to things like printers and ink cartridges, where you get something that you don't really know what you're paying for. In the long run, you're going to pay more. This is a common practice in some ways, right? There's lots of others like that.
You could say net neutrality as well. Like here is something that is cheaper for you now. This printer I can sell you for $50, But of course, you'll have to pay $40 for your ink every couple months.
How's that net neutrality?
Well, with net neutrality, one of the most apparent ways, or one of the ways that we've seen it broken nowadays, is offering you a much lower price on your...
Oh, binge for free stuff.
Yeah,
for like,
binge. But we're going to give you the videos that of people who sign up with our back-end service so that we can
you can have unlimited YouTube videos and so on.
Right. But there's a cost in the future for accepting that deal.
Right.
It may be cheaper now. Right. You may, as a user, see great benefit.
So this plea from this author, I've forgotten his name.
Anil Dash.
This plea to have, you know, please, people, think more about things. Why even make that plea? I mean, in the sense that you're not going to make people pay attention to stuff they don't care about, right? That's...
Right. And so if we're not aware of it, we're not even going to try to fix it. So the other part of his plea is that he believes that... politicians will need to get involved in order to set the rules in a way that will not go down this road, because there are social implications. But I like the appeal to the free market side of things. If we're setting up systems that we think are free markets, but they're entirely rigged and controlled by forces that have no... there's no social good behind those forces, then that sets us up for failure.
What's the Kickstarter that both of you and I are part of about opening up social networks?
Oh, well, it's not specifically, you're going
to
get me.
I know. I'm trying to log into my accounts right now to find it.
Micro.blog.
Micro.blog. Very good, sir. And I can't sign into Kickstarter. as a security precaution, we ask that you change your password. Please close this pop-up. Click forget your password, and we'll send you a password reset email.
That's a new one from them.
Why don't they change the forget to... I didn't forget my password, you liars. Okay, so Kickstarter's trying to get better at security and forcing people to change the password. That's fine, whatever.
So yeah, micro.blog is essentially a open source... Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm not sure if I can say it's open source, but
it's open source, not necessarily.
Right, but it's a system to kind of compete with Twitter, to give a publishing platform for people who want to put short form ideas out there. Like, the best example is Twitter.
In writing in general, it's also would be a Medium competitor and things of that nature. Any kind of social network where people are creating content without it being owned by the social network. So it's like a distributed content creation transformation system. I have yet to see that side of it. I see that there's definitely a creation of a blogging tool and site, but I haven't seen the social aspect. But these walled garden problem, it's a serious problem, and that's kind of what this is that's addressing in general. These walled gardens are a problem.
Right.
I think that, you know, we all understand that. Didi was talking about it a lot last week and the week before, and I think that probably a lot of our listeners are going to kind of get this pretty quickly. I don't think that's going to be a problem. But I don't think that's the issue. You're talking about the issue as being everybody. And most people don't even think about how Facebook is controlling what they think about, right? I mean...
So in the old days, people were trying to educate everybody on how to read the newspaper. There's yellow journalism out there. And there's Hearst, who is controlling the politics of our world. No, this has been something we've
done it for a long time.
Yeah, we can't just ignore it.
So I think that the legislation, the reason I brought that all up, is that the legislation aspect is the way to do it, right? You get people that are in situations of power, understand the probable side effects of this kind of thing, and make legislation that would hopefully improve the scenario. And I agree that us all talking about it and our audience all talking about it will help in the sense that it will bring a general understanding of what is the best practice, what is the things we need to be able to do at this point. So cool. That's a pretty neat. Do you want to talk about anything else around that subject?
I'll just point people to a second article as well.
Of course, the articles we're talking about, everything we talk about, we put up on the pages for the show. And today is the April 12th episode, 2017, episode 12. Of season 17, and all the links are up there. We put lots of extra notes and stuff on, so you can find links and read more from there. And while you're there, visit support, and you can go share, tweet about our show and share it. That'd be great to get more people to be aware.
And if you're interested in this topic, there's another article, which I didn't get a chance to dive into deep enough, but I've heard a lot of good things about along the line of fake news. So Susan Boyle, writing in Back Channel, she's a researcher at Microsoft, basically is outlining the biggest problem of fake news in there. Of course, another market that we have to deal with. And that comes down to the fact that the problem is us.
Yep, it is us. Thank you, Brian. Miles, can you talk a bit about... Well, earlier I mentioned that I use Comcast, but I hate the company, and I complain about them all the time. But the reason I use Comcast is because I don't have a choice.
Yeah, you really don't have any other choices?
I could get AT&T, which offers a much worse DSL service up here.
Much slower, yeah.
Yeah. I would say worse because it's slower, but you're right. It's slower. It might be a better service.
There's satellite.
Satellite has a delay that does not do well. I don't like the delay.
You don't like latency?
Also, it costs more. And it doesn't have the kind of bandwidth. And it has no upload bandwidth, and I do a lot of uploading.
Well, not as nearly as good, yeah.
Yeah. Got anything else? The next one, there's actually there's a couple local, you know, graybeards in this area that actually provide line of sight, you know, Wi-Fi connection points.
So how would Wi-Fi line of sight work for you?
Well, I've got redwood trees, a lot of them.
Oh, we live in a redwood forest,
you know,
right.
There is a mountain I can see that I know to have good network, so I could theoretically take down a couple redwood trees. They're like 120 feet tall. And I've been wanting to do it because it'd be nice to use that material. But anyway, and then I could get a connection. But I'm going to have to do that myself, and I'm going to talk to my friend over on the other side of the hill. And it's going to be really expensive and time-consuming and not as easy. So there's not much competition.
The reason I bring this up is that there's a bit of an argument in the halls of government, in the appointed ones, not the elected. So this would be the FCC chairman, Federal Communications Commission chairman, Ajit Pai, along with his counterpart, Federal Trade Commission, where they are arguing about whether or not it's necessary to have strict privacy rules for ISPs.
This in regards to recently reducing or... removing one of Obama's signed legislation that would have made security privacy better.
Which was under a federal review and wasn't in place yet.
Sure.
But it means that it won't ever go into place.
Right.
Now,
this is the whole scary headlines of ISPs are selling your data. Can sell your data. Yeah.
Now, the rationale given to this was, compared to search engines, broadband providers have a whole lot of competition. And therefore, because they have so much competition, having to put a privacy rules isn't important because if people care about privacy, then they will simply go to the provider that will provide the privacy.
Wait. They're claiming that search engines has no there's no competition in the search engine field, but there is competition in the broadband field.
Yes. That basically boils down the argument that is being put forth by...
I know three search engines I can use right now off the top of my head. I know two ISPs, so they're wrong.
Right, that's the thing. If you decide you don't want to use Google as your search engine, for example, if you do use Google now,
Bing,
you can in a moment, you could go to your web browser, especially if you stopped using Chrome. But you can go to your browser and you can say, "I want to use a different search engine. I want to use DuckDuckGo. I want to use Bing. I want to use all these." There is no real barrier to entry or barrier to transition to get a new search engine. It's just there.
Yep. Okay, and
broadband...
Wait a second. You said, especially if you don't go to Chrome. If you go to Chrome:// settings, on that page, there is a search field with a dropdown. And in that dropdown is Google, Yahoo, Bing, Ask, and AOL. Now, I wouldn't say that those are necessarily great competition, but there's also a manage search engine button. And there's another link that will give you more information on other search fields and how to implement the UI such that your browser can be using that as a default.
Fair enough. I should have known that. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. I mean, I'm just saying that not to show you off, but just that really easy to change a search engine. In fact, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go switch to Bing for a while.
It'll be fun. Tell me how it goes.
DuckDuckGo.
Now, that said, if you want to change your ISP from Comcast to AT&T, is it as easy as switching your search engine?
No, I've got to have hardware delivered to my house, and they will make me pay for someone to come here and wire it, even though I know better than they
do. And tell you that they're going to be here between the hours of 2 and 5.
No, it's
they're
ridiculous.
Never there.
It's ridiculous. Last time Comcast was out, the property I'm on has multiple buildings. And one of the buildings across the way is within Ethernet range. And so when we buried the power line, because the telephone pole was falling over, so I dug a trench and we buried the power line, did all that. When I did that, of course, I threw an extra line in the ground for Ethernet, right? It's a small half-inch PVC, goes the full distance, no big deal. I put a string in at the same time, and I pulled the Ethernet line. And then my neighbor that moved in wanted to do Comcast. And the Comcast company was like, well, we can't connect to that house. But I was like, oh, there's a, you can just use the same line. Just when you pull the Ethernet out, pull a string, pull them both. You know, my intention was them to pull both of them. But the cable company just used my Ethernet to pull the Comcast line through and left the stupid Comcast line through, which, of course, is completely useless. Next neighbor moves in. They're like, do you have Ethernet? I'm like, use Wi-Fi. I don't want to have to do that again. Anyway, yeah, Comcast even, like, messed up my infrastructure. But go on.
No, I think I pretty much covered it.
Yeah, they're not... I did switch to Bing. It's really interesting. I switched to the settings and I opened a new tab, and all of a sudden my whole Chrome interface was a Bing interface. It's got news at the bottom and search engine. And
when you do a type a query into the address bar, do you get suggestions with it?
Yeah.
So it really is a seamless transition.
Totally. It was completely seamless to do this. In fact, I kind of like the interface. It looks nice.
Oh, no.
Did we just blow a massive hole in the FCC chairman's argument within 5 minutes?
Who put this? What is this FCC chairman's history?
Oh, who, I mean, is he? How long has he been a telecom executive?
Yeah, is he a telecom executive?
Oh yeah.
Of course he is.
So stupid.
Oh, man, that's so frustrating.
No, that's not as frustrating as the fact that I know out on Highway 9, the my main road. I know that there's fiber laid under that road. I can see every 200 yards where the
little
where the ditch
pokey.
Witch dug that hole. It's sitting right there, and no one could tap into it.
So you drive by it every day knowing that it's not for you.
Isn't the fundamental solution to have some, incentives for people to lay line and then make sure that there's an open market on who gets to tie into that line so that multiple ISPs can sprout up everywhere?
That would be nice. Moving on?
Sure.
All right. I guess you got some Mac suggestions for us, Brian.
Oh, yeah. So this was a kind of a fun week in the Macosphere. A topic that just keeps kind of flittering on the edge of our show every once in a while is how Mac users, pro Mac users, have been feeling neglected and underwhelmed by recent releases. You've been slightly underwhelmed by your USB-C ports.
Yes. And I don't know, the fingerprint is nice on this device, but other than that, I'm not impressed with it at all.
I still like the touch bar, not that I get to use it.
Hey, if any software actually used it that I use, that would be great. The one thing, the terminal, because the terminal, of course, is Mac's terminal, and I just didn't install iTerminal on this machine when I got it. I've just been using terminal. And terminal does have interface on the touch bar. And so what I can do in terminal is I can bookmark a position in terminal. Do you know that you can bookmark terminal, Miles? Do you know that? So, you know, in terminal, it's just a bunch of text, right? You're typing stuff and you're getting logs back and stuff. Anytime you want, you can push a bookmark and then you can jump to that line again. Sure, right? So there, on my touch bar, there's a bookmark button and there's also a color wheel so I can change the background color of my window. Look, this is because that's a useful feature. So anytime I want, I can like, oh, yeah, I want to change my color of my background. Let's see.
I see you keep touching your screen. How's that going for you?
Well, the touch bar makes you want to touch your screen because, like, you're touching the touch bar. Anyway, moving on.
So the pro stuff, the big news this week was Apple came to bloggers and said, yeah, we're sorry. We hear you guys are screaming about you wanting a new Mac Pro, which it's been over 3 years. And
not the MacBook Pro, but the Mac Tower or trash can. Whatever.
Exactly. And we're going to have that one out for you in a year or two.
It was really interesting that they said so far out they're going to release this Mac Pro in a long time from now, which means that they're kind of like either they just started working on it, they hadn't been working on it, or they changed direction. What's your take on it?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, when you read all the rumor sites, it seems to imply that they just started the project in earnest pretty recently, within weeks or months.
Well, and one of the reasons why it seems pretty clear that way is that they do talk about how they're going to make their own display for it. It will be an Apple branded display. And last round of new devices, they actually partnered and didn't release their own display. And that display actually was a complete bomb because of noise problems with it. So in the sense that they knew going to do that, it's kind of like the timeline kind of looks like they just made that decision. And there has been, you're right, there's been in the Macosphere, there has been a lot of complaints about the lack of a pro machine. Right now, they're still selling a desktop machine that was created in 2013.
Right. And
it's horrible.
Well, I mean, okay, the CPU on it's good. The memory bandwidth is pretty good. Of course, the big problem is it was sold as a machine that has great GPUs, and it doesn't
hasn't
anymore.
Kept speed,
unless you can upgrade it every 6 months, you can't keep up with it.
Right. I don't think you can do VR on it. I mean, it's not.
No,
it's not going to.
Well, so all of this discussion brought up something that I completely forgot about. But when that Mac Pro was released, the super tiny little trash can project of theirs, The notable thing about it is there's no room to expand it. I think you could add memory in yourself, but that was about it. Like most Apple products.
I think you'd change the hard drives too, or hard drive. But go
ahead. Well, no, I mean, those are SSD chips are right into...
Are they soldered? No, I think the hard drives were replaceable. I'm saying that you're right.
Anyways.
There's no expansion. And the old cheese grater one had tons of expansion ports.
Right. Most people's definition of a pro machine is that you can expand it, and one of the things that gets expanded most time is the GPU. Well, this made everybody look at Thunderbolt, because what is Thunderbolt?
It's an extension of the eSATA bus. Not the eSATA,
no,
PCIe.
PCIe
bus.
Right. So it's kind of like having the PCI bus on the outside of your computer. So back when that trash can Mac was released, there was a lot of talk about, we can use the Thunderbolt PCI bus to connect a GPU to it, and we don't need to have internal upgrades. We can add, not only can you add hard drives and other things to your machine, but you can actually add a GPU to it.
That was 2013.
Yeah, 2013.
I haven't seen any of these cards. I'm sure there's some exist, but
well, the
not
Mac,
so much success.
The Mac has never supported it, but there are hints that support may be coming in the future. But more than that, people are hacking it. And people are getting some level of GPU support with
Thunderbolt?
Over Thunderbolt with their Macs.
Oh, interesting.
So you could, the real dream of this is you can have your laptop, your MacBook Pro laptop running with your USB C port that has Thunderbolt 3 on it. And you can connect in a GPU, external GPU, and that thing will be able to give you souped up great GPU power and run on your built-in screen or on an external monitor. And so obviously you can't carry around one of these hot, power-hungry GPUs in a laptop, but when you're sitting at your desktop, maybe you could take advantage of it for gaming or for 3D rendering, any of that.
I don't know. This kind of like, what-if kind of coolness, you're right, it gets exciting, but until I actually see it operating and actually can play and touch it and buy it, not that impressed. I mean,
right. So yeah. There's a couple things to know, and iMore has a great little article kind of going over this. But NVIDIA has new graphics cards coming out with support for the Mac operating system. They're They're building in support for this line of cards.
That's funny because you can't buy a Mac right now that can take a card.
Exactly. You'd have to use an old cheese grater.
Right.
But they do make enclosures for running Thunderbolt to it. Now, what you can't do is two-way communication. In other words, you can't have your computer use the GPU and send the video back through the Thunderbolt and display it on your internal laptop screen.
Right.
But it is possible to run an external monitor off of the GPU card.
But graphics cards are not only for display. You can also use their parallel processing
and
for
especially,
doing things.
Especially NVIDIA, because they have their CUDA system.
But could you use that through Thunderbolt?
I don't see the details on that specifically.
This is the kind of stuff that's be fun to see, definitely, as it comes out. Well, thanks. Well, we got one more story for today's show, and that is that a bit about DRM and fighting it.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect that farmers would be on the same level as smartphone owners with regard to technology, would you?
I would imagine all farmers have cell phones, but then again, most people have small.
I meant with regard to farming equipment.
Okay.
Because you don't normally think of a cell phone as a farming equipment.
No.
A farming implement. But one of the things that we've been finding for new tractors, which may cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, is that they have their own set of DRM, as it were. They are software-based, very much like modern passenger vehicles are. Mm-hmm. And right now, in the past, if a tractor broke down, someone went in, they fiddled with the engine, tried to find some way to fix it, and fixed it. As things become more computerized, that is no longer available. In fact, companies are now pushing to say, for example, John Deere, that you are not allowed to without voiding your warranty. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to go into your tractor.
Now, keep in mind, one of the major reasons for this is that John Deere has different software packages available to different people for different costs, but the hardware is the same. So you can buy a tractor from John Deere, which is a manual tractor, and drive it. Even though it has a complete remote-controlled capabilities, you haven't bought that. And then you can turn that service on for a fee. Of course, it's just a different running source code that's running.
Right.
And so people, of course, farmers want access to this so they can write their own operating system.
Right. And owner's manuals for vehicles used to have all of the parts, and you could order the parts or go to the junkyard and try to find the part.
Or manufacture it yourself.
Right. But these software APIs and these libraries, this firmware, all black box.
Yeah.
You don't get any access to them. You don't even get the API to be able to work with them. You can't manufacture a replacement.
So do you buy a John Deere tractor these days, or do you sign a license agreement?
A little bit of both. And we have covered this topic before.
Sure, we have. Yeah.
We covered it in the beginning of 2016 in February.
And I just want to remind people, we're calling these a tractor. What these are is industrial factories on wheels that go over land.
True.
These things are automated mega machines.
I do want to tell you guys about LifeTrac 6. It's a tractor prototype specifically designed to be able to be built by someone with a welding gear and access to a home store. And all the blueprints and software and hardware are available for free. And it's an open source project to make tractors.
That's awesome.
So it's pretty cool. I wanted to build one. It's about $6,000 worth of materials.
So it's kind of like OpenStack, but for tractors.
Yep.
So,
and there's a whole bunch of farm equipment that the same
wonderful
works on.
Is it a straight up tractor, or are we talking about automated goodness here?
Well, so I'll show you a picture of it. I don't know. I haven't looked at it lately because I was looking for a complete manual system just for having a tractor.
Mm-hmm.
It's box steel and welded together. And of course, different people have made them and modified them. And there's a whole community of people working on these kinds of things.
Which is really interesting because modern farming is really about buying this massive, expensive equipment that you can never quite fully get out of from under the debt of. So a movement where you can actually build your machinery and make a system where you can make money from farming, that's ideal.
Yeah, there is an aspect to this, which is also that in the past, when you bought something, you could have the parts, you could mess around with it, you could tailor it to your designs, and, you know, weld some part that you needed onto it, fiddle with the injection port, fuel injection ports, stuff like that. But the carburetor, so fuel injection tend to be more complicated. But the trend now for everything that you buy is a black box, and you are now effectively not allowed to fiddle, to mess with it, to tweak it to your purposes or to improve upon it, is, I think, also just damaging to the vibrancy of a society, that people don't feel like they can participate in the things that they own.
Sounds like Brazil.
You have made a fantastic argument for why I should hate all my iOS devices that I love so dearly.
Well, the thing is, iOS devices, they, in general, were jailbroken. I used to jailbreak mine.
Well, I only did to get Grand Stream, whatever Google Voice came from on there.
Right, but the idea, though, was that you did this so that you could, because someone saw a vacuum, they went, hey, this would be a neat feature to have. A lot of people saw that and were like, hell yeah, that's a really cool thing to do. And you wanted to open up your device to be able to make those changes that you wouldn't normally be allowed to. And you don't hold Apple responsible for those changes. You go like, hey, I hacked my phone. And then you say, okay, I want to take away that that jailbreak, and I'm going to reflash it back to the original. Great, fine. And that's the way it should work. This notion
First off, Apple has never supported the idea of jailbreaking.
Right.
They always try to close those packages
down. I know, but I mean, that idea, though, is still important.
See any difference between John Deere and Apple in this situation.
Except for John Deere selling machinery that they don't give you full use of unless you pay them
more
money.
So is Apple. Apple's giving you...
I'm not defending Apple about that. I'm talking about the virtue of hacking. The virtue of being able to manipulate what you own.
I think it's good, but then again, you have an iOS device. Why don't you have like an Android device where you can actually do more of that? I mean, yes, it's a noble thing.
Wait, let me answer that. Let me answer that because that's actually an important question.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. I have considered it, and I have purchased a few apps on Apple that I don't want to repurchase, or they don't have equivalents on Android.
So you're stuck in the market.
But at the same
time, you've already brought the printer, so now you're just going to keep on buying ink cartridges.
But there's also the fact that I have a lot of my family who are on iOS and they use iMessage, and trying to switch them over to something else or to pay the texting fees becomes prohibitive. It means that I'd have to go to each and every single family member and friend to try to get them to go onto Google Hangouts, except that's going away.
You know, Brian and I recently tried to get a group of people. We all have kids together and we all like vacation together to get the kids together and such. And Brian and I tried to get all of them on one messaging service that wasn't allocated to one of these big boys.
I want to give my wife credit. It was really Melanie. She was desperately trying to get this work because where we live, we don't have consistent cell phone service.
Right. What do we use as a system? Signal?
Yeah, we tried to use Signal, and it was blocked by a single family that just didn't want to use this.
So then we're like, I don't know, Hangouts and Google Facebook.
And my wife continues to not be a part of the conversation for hours or days before that one text message actually comes into her phone.
Yeah, that reminds me. I should just move all my family over to Signal. That's just a good idea.
You know, it's a little buggy.
And you can't have multiple devices easily. Unless you're using Google Chrome and another device.
Yeah. So with Signal, when you change a device, like during the whole process, I switched phones and all of a sudden my ID changed. And therefore, the entire conversation stream, when I tried to communicate with it, generated a new communication stream. Everyone was confused. It wasn't seamless.
And did those IDs ever get linked again?
No, they don't get linked again.
I tried to do this too.
Yours, you had the same problem having your account. So I wouldn't recommend Signal because of that problem. I also recently, my grandmother passed away recently. And during her illness and stuff, we were using Slack to communicate. And I didn't talk about it much on the show because she listened to the show regularly. I didn't want to talk about how we were helping manage her life, discreetly. Slack is really good for this kind of thing. I mean, we use it for GeekSpeak. The trouble with it, of course, is that you kind of create a community and then everyone has to be part of that community. Mm-hmm. So not so great when it's like a distributed community where there's not, but I think for our purpose of the kids and stuff, that would have been a better solution in the sense that it was like a chat group.
I'm on some Slacks that have over 10,000 members.
No, they're great, but they are, you are connecting to one community. It's not like when you and I talk on Slack, we're talking through GeekSpeak, right? It's not like it's a private conversation. It's like, I mean, we can talk privately, but we have to be connected through a community.
It's funny. I can hear my mom's voice in my head right now. Oh, another thing to learn.
There is that too. So just keep your iOS device. That's what we're coming down to, right? So,
Mom doesn't want to learn something. I'm sticking with the phone that my mom has.
I have a car that I know people have hacked. It's a Leaf, a Nissan Leaf. And you can hack it. There's a few different things you can do with it. Pretty much the only thing I want to do, is I want to be able to switch into stealth mode. Because it actually creates amplified noise. It has a speaker that makes noise when you drive under a certain speed so that people know you're there so you don't accidentally bump into people. Of course, it's not really loud enough for people to hear you, especially teenagers. They just don't hear you at all. But the idea is that it's supposed to be, you know, notifying you. Well, sometimes
it follows DMV regulations that when you go into a crosswalk, you have to have engine noise so that people who are visually impaired can know that you're there.
Right. And I am totally fine with it having engine noise and all that. I just want to be able to switch it off and on when I'm on private roads. But also, the more annoying one is the backups. The backup beeps. Beep, beep. You know, really irritating truck.
Is it loud on the outside as well as inside?
It's pretty loud on the outside. Like the other day, I came to pick up my kids early, but I was just going to hang out while my son was waking up and from his mom's place. And she called me. What are you doing in the driveway? You know, because, of course, I pulled up and then I like turned around. And it's like bleep, bleep, bleep. And she woke her up. And so obviously, I'd like to have a kill switch. And I can hack that. I can do that. But for me, it's not worth the time and effort to hack it. I don't want to modify the operating system. I'd like to have updates happen. I want to, you know, all those things. That's the reason I'm not doing it, not because I want to control what Nissan's doing with me. Mm-hmm. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. So use our stuff any way you'd like. Just give us some credit. I want to thank Michael Newman of Pet Star Music for our theme song. And also, I want to thank Greg Merkley up in Canada, who gave us today's title, Linux Bricks Siri with Fake Tractor.
And I want to thank our patrons, Chris Irwin, Pat Hader, Jeremy Devine, Jim Warner, Glenn Nelson, David Holloway, Tim Ramsey, Alexis Chen, Nirajas Clinius, Joe Winston. Also, Marcus Hall, Jonas Rulio, Zach Smitherson, John Vizana, Double Busy, Joe Kyle, Christy Ramsey, Ben Powell, Ted Mazo, Judy Enos, Mike Coppersmith, Spider Rogue, Brandon Holloway, and a whole bunch of other awesome people that listen to the show, donate money. Thank you so much for your contributions. Please do feel free to post any of our shows on any of the social medias you may participate in to spread the word to your friends that might enjoy the program.
I also want to thank Brian Young and Miles Edom. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's always fun.
For 2.5 weeks, we've been dealing with bad well.
Wait. How many years have you lived here?
9 years.
How many problems have you dealt with that involve the well or the septic?
I've redone wires, and I've done so much with this system on this property. It's complicated and hard and all that. But what's happened recently, and I mean, okay, first off, when I was 8 or 7, I moved onto this property. And then I took away some time off and I moved back. So I have a lot of history with this property. I just learned something from my wife who did some research on this that I went, duh. It was like such an obvious thing I'd never thought of. And I thought it was so smart. We have a whole bunch of iron in our water. I've always known we had iron in our water because when I was younger, all the toilets and the sinks and all that had like a ring of iron. You couldn't see the iron in the water. It wasn't ever cloudy or anything. It was just there. We knew it was iron water.
It wasn't enough to be toxic.
It wasn't. Well, my sister had kidney failure, so who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
Never mind.
Still has kidney failure. It's kind of always a thing. But you knew it because when water evaporated, there'd be rust stains. And while I was gone, somebody installed a water purification system. And what it basically is a big tank with a filter in it. Inside the filter, they create ozone. Using ultraviolet light, and they pump that down into the water and bubble it up inside of a filter. And when they bubble it up inside the filter, water is drawn from outside through the filter membrane and up, and therefore stuff is collected. And what's collected in that tank is all this rust, all this iron oxide. And what I finally got when Maggie was looking at the system and why it was failing because there was too much sediment in the tank. Basically, for 9 years, it hasn't been cleared out, and it's just filling with this sediment. And it's very... very fine. Some of it's very, very fine, and it stays. What is it called when you have a material in water that
does soluble, insoluble?
No, it floats in water. It's a suspension. So it's a pretty good suspension, and it's very small molecules, so the other filter doesn't separate them out. In any case, why is there so much sludgy rust inside there? Well, because there's iron in the water, and then we inject O3 into the water, and it oxidizes the iron in the water, making the particles. But that's why we don't have iron in our drinking water anymore, because it's collected in the tank. So we basically have this giant iron oxide creation system.
Rust.
Iron oxide creation. I mean, it's like a foot and a half of this stuff at the bottom of this tank. This tank's pretty tall. It's so, really thick now.
So, but it kind of failed all at once, didn't it?
So what happened, the failure system this time, was that the pump failed at the bottom of it. And so we ran out of water in the tank. And so when the water drops a certain point, I have to open a lower valve. We open a lower valve, you start getting the sludge. So then we called the pump company because I didn't have the time to do this. I actually have a job. and so instead of me trying, I thought it was a capacitor. So I called the company, said, just come out, fix this. They'll have caps on hand for the run capacitor or the startup capacitor or whatever it was. They came down. They said, nope, it's not that. It's actually the motor. I'm like, oh, that's not good. Because when you have a pump that's at the bottom of, you know, multiple hundreds of feet, you have to pull that whole thing. And to pull that whole thing, you have to get a crane in there and pull it up. It's like a big process. So they had to wait a week before they could get the truck there to do that. So we had to order water. And when we ordered water, they dumped the water from the top at a high volume. It mixed all the sludge. So then I was like, okay, let's wait a while. But the ozonation filter system, we didn't turn off. And all that really does is causes a small current and mixes. So it's basically mixing and mixing. So for a week, it's like, oh, we have to turn off the system, let it settle, so all this suspension stuff will go down. So we waited for 3-4 days, then we finally turned it back on. It still failed. Oh, we had another water delivery during that time. and that did it again. So that's been what's happening. We finally got the pump going. We finally got the pump flowing, and we had to get it set for like 4 days. All this time, of course, you can use the water.
So wait, are there any health implications? Because I always wondered this when I went to a grill that was totally rusty.
I don't think iron oxide's a problem.
I don't think it is.
I don't really think it is a problem. But then again, I'll tell you when my kids have kidney failure. So so we've not been drinking the water, obviously. We've been bringing in stuff. But we also, like recently, I showered before work and all day my eyes burned and my skin. Maggie, my wife, used a baby wipe on her face and pulled off a layer of brown, right? So we're all like covered in rust. Clothes are all brown. It's just, it's nasty. So the long and the short of it's not solved yet. We're getting it cleaned out on Thursday. But the thing that was amazing to me is I never put together that we were creating the iron oxide by injecting ozone in there, O3. Hilarious.
Creating okay, so problems. The EPA does not consider iron in well water to be more than a secondary contaminant, meaning it doesn't have a direct impact on health.
Except for the burning eyes.
Iron or iron oxide? Does it matter?
Well, okay.
We need iron.
Iron in all forms. Wait a second.
Is iron oxide soluble to the system?
But definitely right now, I would not want to get in a fight with Magneto.
There you go.
There you go. Was that geeky enough?
No.
Anything else? Miles, you said that you wanted to show me a trailer, and I watched the trailer, and I was very excited.
Yes. Thor Ragnarok.
Watch the trailer.
Yeah.
It's the new Marvel big-time movie.
Right. And if you are like me and unlike the other geeks in the air room with me now, and Stephen King's It with Tim Curry back in the day left a lasting mark in your memory, there's also a trailer for an update on that one. Show that to Lyle. And your response was?
I said, no, not for me.
Yeah. Okay. Why not? Yeah, that looks scary.
It looks horrifying. So, it looks so horrifying. I kind of
it's a
my
horror
kids,
film.
My
That's
kids
the
have
point.
Been saying they want to see more horror movies. I should play that to my daughters. I think they'd really like that movie. They'd never sleep again. But the book is horrifying and scary. Anything else?
Oh, I could talk for a while.
What else you got?
A coding thing. You want to talk a little coding?
I'll do coding. I love coding.
So I've been thinking about this a lot lately because I come from computer graphics. That was my first career. We have incredibly complex applications that are generally graphical with you know, there's scripting languages that are involved and stuff like that. But our problem set involves a lot of graphical thinking. And so our tools were graphical. And I've been doing iOS programming for 5 years now. Mm-hmm. And it just dawned on me how much I liked playing with programming environments that were GUI-based.
Graphical. Oh.
In some way, GUI-based. I mean, there's lots of things out there for teaching programming to kids. There's the Scratch language that shows.
Are you saying that you like Zibs?
Let's not go there yet.
Okay, sorry.
But it just dawned on me. We're making these non-linear, interactive applications that they're tied together in so many different ways. And yet we're using a form of language that's inherently a stream of letters and symbols. And I want to be able to look at my code in multiple ways, reorganize it. And I'm just, why are all the leading edge languages so text-based without an IDE that helps you deal with this in a non-linear, more graphical way?
Interesting.
I mean, I think I know the answer. I think it's just because to be on the leading edge, you don't have time to build that much into an IDE. But
well, identifiers, how do you refer to them in a graphical way? Are you talking about the relationships between items being graphical?
An object graph in your application, that's a graphical concept of how things are connected together.
Because those exist.
Yeah, but they're not part of the IDEs.
Yes, they are.
Who? Eclipse. You're going to say Eclipse, aren't you?
Well, Eclipse has them there, but any one of them that does UML or something equivalent to that, you can generate the code
now,
from...
We're not talking about generate a UML from a source code. That's just running a program to do something.
Okay.
What I think you're... And I'll translate this. So I have a relatively complicated application that we use for work that's the back-end Groovy layer. And basically, it's called Interactive Common Original. Let's see. Interactive Original Common. It's basically... manages all our interactive content. We have some interactive content on Netflix. And this is a big groovy application which is used by multiple servers. So Android application, the website application, the TV application, and iOS application all interact with this service to create data flows back to our apps. So most of it is shared code, and then some of it's slightly different. So iOS needs different images. It's, you know, there's five different image sizes for iOS depending on the resolution and all that. Android needs different sizes. TV only always needs one because they're always 1080, the lucky bastards.
Or and seven. You, I don't think give a lot of stuff in 720.
Actually, 720. But they're moving. They're actually moving to 1080. And someone was going, "Oh no, we're gonna have two different images." I'm like, "What? iOS might release another one tomorrow that I need to deal with." Oh, I'm so frustrated. Of course, we've solved the problem. We have another library that does that. Anyway, this application has, you know, a request constructor and some factories and some translation levels and this thing called A-B test and A-B test constructor. There's all these different objects that tie together to produce the flow that you need. When you dive into it and work on it for a while, you get all of that kind of loads into your brain, right? So what if I've been working on this app for this library for a while, I understand it all. It fits. It's no problem. I can move around. And I kind of even know the file names. And so I just open my editor and I search for the file name or auto open the file name and it opens. But what I've been learning lately is that when I leave the application for a while, work on iOS side for a while, the client side for a while, and then go back to it, the only way I can find stuff is where in the file tree it is. So I know that, oh, there's the AB config, or the thing that I need to deal with, which I haven't thought of the name of yet, I know its function is up in the top third of the file system. And then I go up there and it says like A-B test. And I open that and go, yeah, that's where it is. And so I'm navigating the file tree using my ability to map geography, the human ability to understand geography. I'm using that to find my source code, even though it's only structured alphabetically in folder structures. Like what it's really doing is structuring that way. And it just happens to be that spatially it always is the same. And so I can use my spatial reasoning.
And the reason why it's spatially organized that way is on one attribute of these files.
Alphabetical.
Names.
Yeah.
But there's a million ways to think about the role of that bit of code in your application.
And more than that, it's Java, right? So there's public interfaces and private interfaces.
Right.
Like the data is there to generate a real-time visualization system. And it wouldn't really matter what it is as long as it's consistent. It'd be a lot easier for me to navigate that library. Every time I'd open it, I'd understand it. In fact, when I need to teach other people how to use it, I go and make a pseudo, you know, graph. So I can say, this module does this and this module does this, and have space around it so that we can talk about it. So, yeah, the IDEs don't have that at all. And don't even get me started on the client-side application in iOS. iOS is the same way. It's just folder structures. You know rebuttal, Miles?
I guess I'm thinking of my time in Google, they had code search.
How do you find stuff?
Yeah, you look for whatever the function name that you were looking for. You don't have to know a file name.
How do you need to know the function name? How do you know what the function name is?
You can put in just like a keyword and see what comes up.
But,
yeah.
Right. So that.
But yeah, you're right. I guess you also looked in the area.
Okay, so this is why we're software engineers and not business people. Because if one of us was a business person, we would produce that thing right now. We'd go out and start working on it. Because it would be awesome.
It would be awesome.
And you make money.
You can take people that I mean, okay, code is about abstracting, or programming is about abstracting ideas into units that are manageable, right?
I'd actually disagree with that.
Oh, yeah? How would you?
Code, I believe, is the opposite direction. It's reifying ideas, reifying abstract concepts into a concrete logical.
Define reifying in this context.
Is that
taking
a word?
Yes. Taking something abstract and putting it into something more concrete.
What Brian is talking about is using metaphor to understand complex computer problems. So our, you know, language is metaphor. All of our applications are metaphor. We produce a language as we're writing the app to help us understand it. So we use that. That is not the mathematical abstract. That's not a clarity of what it is. That's a way of being able to think about it
in order to model a real world idea in the computer, in order to build your application, you're going to build more and more abstractions into it to make it manageable, to make it reusable code.
When you say abstractions, do you mean abstractions, or do you mean, because abstraction is getting away from the truth,
or do you mean, that how you define it?
Well,
it kind of is. You're putting another layer in between what you are inputting to how it's actually being done.
Well,
abstraction layers are.
You start with a concrete final idea, and you find the commonalities with other concrete ideas, and you abstract that out to be a manageable concept that can be applied to both. That's one way to do it.
I feel this conversation is a little abstract.
Yeah, exactly. But this is the point. Programming becomes very abstract.
Yeah.
But there are connections and there are relationships.
I don't think abstract is the right word here.
No?
No. If I'm telling you a story about a man walking down the street and I describe more and more about him, I'm not adding abstractions. I'm adding more clarity. You weren't listening.
No, I heard
that. Okay, so it's not that you're adding abstractions. You're trying to come up with narratives that allow you to understand it, and then you're creating structures that are tighter narratives so you can understand it better. Metaphor is a better way to say that than narrative. But does that make sense? What are you guys looking at?
Rarefy. How do you say that?
Reify.
Reify.
What does reify define? To read the definition.
Verb, formal, make something abstract more concrete or real.
So lots of ones and zeros is very abstract, but a video game is very real.
The first definition from, Bing is not telling me what source this dictionary definition is from, but the abstraction, first definition is the quality of dealing with ideas rather than events. Two, freedom from representational qualities in art. Three, a state of preoccupation. Four, the process of considering something independently of its associations, attributes, or concrete accompaniments.
Spell it?
Abstraction?
Oh, abstraction. That's okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I started with that.
You did.
Okay.
I missed that. Sorry.
Wow. It's interesting. That doesn't... none of those things fit what I think of as... the word.
Something that was done at Google were Go links, where you would type.
Yeah, we do a lot of that too.
Yeah, Go and then whatever keyword is, because you wouldn't know where to find something, and so you just say, okay, this is the concept.
I love the same type of problem exists at Netflix too. You know, you're like, well, I need to deal with somebody's history with regards to continue watching. There's a row, you know. What service manages that? So then you start searching for it, and you finally end up like looking on your source code to find the method you call, and then you do a global search against all source code repository at the site, you know, to find the source thing, and then you do a blame on that file to find the person, and then you find the person in the white pages. Hopefully, they still work there.
Right.
White pages, most people do; they don't leave Netflix very quick. Then you find the department they're in. Sometimes you just email and go, "What? Where am I doing?" You're like, so it's this long chain to try to find something. But that's because software is extremely complicated, right? That's how I think of it. It's like it's not possible to keep all this stuff in your brain.
And software engineers are not known for their documentation.
We have a lot of documentation in the group I'm in, and I never can find it.
Isn't the problem with documentation that it's not inherently a part of the description of your app, and therefore gets out of sync and not cared for?
I only want documentation.
That's the whole point. Is that in software engineering, people are like, okay, you need to update your code so it doesn't go through bit rot. You need to make sure that it's kept up to date and still works. And so you put in unit tests. And when you make change to the code, you have to update the unit tests, right?
Well,
that's a given.
Well, when you try to push your changes, your unit tests run. If they're broken, you can't push.
Right. But okay. Also,
so
when you add new functionality or when
return
there's...
Return true. Yeah,
when you add new functionality or you fix a bug, you add another test because it doesn't cover that existing case. But we don't do that for documentation. We could have policies that say when you're making a change, you have to update the documentation that goes along with it.
Yeah, but you can't you can't run a process to check if the documentation's accurate.
But you can have
you had 4 lines of change in your pull request. You have to have 8 lines of documentation change. So you go over there and like fix spelling.
Well, that's the thing, though. For some cases, yeah, the documentation is going to be more than the code. And other times, it's going to be a lot of code and a little bit of documentation to tell you what that thing does. But so yes, there's no unit test for that. But my point was that you make unit tests for that code to try to keep them in sync. But by and large, the companies that I've been at have not had the same
thing. Integration.
When you're going through a code review,
they haven't had the same.
They don't say, "Hey, you need to also update this, or we're not going to give the okay for this."
Right.
Code review.
The code review should point to the documentation. So the person reads the documentation. The person that's doing code review should read the documentation and your source code and go, "Actually, you need to change the documentation." That's a good idea. See. That's another good idea. If we were business people, we'd do something about that.
Well,
okay, can we get back to abstraction? I think that the way we use abstraction in software development, you're clinging on to as a terminology in a different way to describe what we do in general. And we don't just do abstractions in software development, right? We do clarifications. We do – I mean, there's a lot of structures that we generate. There's patterns that we generate.
Right, and – and the more abstract ones can be more – or actually, the more generalized ones can be applied in more places.
Sure. The term that I was thinking about earlier is domain-specific languages, right? We generate domain-specific languages to be able to talk about the software we're writing. But, Miles, it is true that all code is metaphoric and abstract from what's actually happening. What's actually happening is shift registers are moving bits around. Right?
Wait. That actually was my point. When I was saying reify is the opposite of abstraction.
Yeah, but you're saying that when you write software, you're making it – you're reifying. Is that the right way to use that word?
You're taking an abstract concept in your mind and trying to put it into a concrete logical sequence of events.
Okay, and I disagree in one way. What you're trying to do is you're trying to get a computer to do something that you want it to do. But the steps involved in doing that are so complex that you have to create another type of language on top of that to be able to describe that problem. That's why we have all these patterns.
You're talking about a programming language as that intermediary.
No, I'm talking about your application. Your application is also a programming language. Like
the libraries that you use, sure.
But libraries you use, but also methodologies you use. Like the idea of object-oriented programming, that is so that we can use our human conceptual ways of thinking to translate into code. It's just a way of writing code so that it works for us.
We have different ideas about what object-oriented programming is for.
What do you think it's for?
Object-oriented programming is a way to encapsulate code, making it a black box. It makes it much easier to unit test and keep it separate from other things.
But what else does it make it easier to do? For us, it makes it easier for us to comprehend it.
The notion of making a class based upon an object like in the real world and – That paradigm, I thought, was always suspect.
No, you're right that the way we always describe it by you have a car and you have four wheels and all cars are vehicles. That's a subclass. Right. That whole thing. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the encapsulation of concepts so that you can then think at a higher level. Like when we want to talk about the concept of having deja vu, we use that word. Because if I wanted to use a more rich description of what that was, I would have to go through a long paragraph to describe it. And once that story was done, you'd understand it, but we'd lose our train of thought. So we can talk at a higher level by using words.
See, I don't see that's it as a higher level. So I just see it, encapsulation and higher level I don't see as being the same thing.
But would you agree that deja vu encapsulates enough of an idea that we don't have to hold that entire idea in our head, but with using deja vu as the stand-in, we can understand its relationship to other concepts?
I'm sorry, deja vu, you've lost me.
You'll think about it later.
Do you know what the word deja vu means?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. If you wanted to talk about that feeling without that word, how rich a conversation would we have?
Okay, sorry. When you're talking about deja vu with regard to programming, that kind
Sorry. I use that word in talks and stuff because it's an easy word for people to understand about different languages have the have concepts that you can speak you can speak differently in different languages because the language itself allows for it. And that is why, like, when we talk about computer science type stuff, we use complex words that we don't always describe because it's inherent to us. When we talk about object-oriented programming, we don't go to describe what that is. When we talk about layer of abstraction, when we're talking about that, we all know what that meant, right?
Okay.
So because we can use the vocabulary, we're able to have a more rich conversation about the topic hand.
Yes.
Okay. So what you're doing when you're writing software is building up pieces that allow you to fit that stuff into your brain.
Okay.
That's partly why these patterns exist, is for us to be able to understand the software.
Okay, that's where you lost me with regard to deja vu, because I don't see that as deja vu.
Deja vu,
deja vu.
Okay.
Deja vu, the word, encapsulates an idea without saying that idea. It hides it behind an interface.
Okay. The other way to think about this is, let's just talk about temperature. If you want to talk about temperature...
I guess I studied French, so I know that it means literally already seen. So it actually doesn't really go different.
Yes, but when you say...
There's more to it than
déjà vu.
That,
when you say déjà vu in English, we all know what that feeling is, if you know what the word is.
Okay.
Okay. But let's talk about temperature. For you and I to have an interesting conversation about temperature, like, what's the temperature of this room? Blah, 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 blah. We're using this word temperature. We know what temperature actually is. We could go into the details of what temperature is, but we just abstract that away, and we go, well, that's the sensation we have on our body. That's the, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that it represent, but we can use the word temperature and not have to go into, well, it's vibrating molecules. You know, we don't have to go into the depth of it. So déjà vu is just a fill in for that same concept, just a complex concept wrapped around a word.
Okay, at a higher level. Okay.
So you don't think of that? You don't think of language that way and programming that way? I'm surprised. I thought you turned me on to this idea.
He's gotten more concrete about it.
Yeah. When I think about having a short, I think of like having a shorthand, having words and they mean a larger concept. And those were like with regard to talking about race politics and not wanting to rehash everything that you've done every single time. So, yeah, it is a shortcut that way. To think of the higher order problem. I mean, you may be right. I hadn't thought of it that way. But some of it seems... I don't know, there's something about it that feels like it's made more lofty than it is.
Oh, I don't mean anything lofty by it. Okay. But like even the concept of, well, it's an object that you can test. You can put unit tests around it because it's isolated and it's a black box. All of those things also allow you to then go, well, that's a thing that I can think about as handling that problem.
As a continuous, as a singular atomic unit.
Sure. And therefore, if you've got 50 of those, it's a lot easier than just one giant script that has a whole bunch of procedural functions.
Okay, yes.
Right?
Got it.
And because you're able to put it in your head better. Part of that putting your head better, I would say, because I'm more of a visual type person, is actually making a map in your mind. So in my software problem of the Interactive Common module that I work on, that thing has a map in my mind. Unfortunately, until I get really richly into it, it's not a functional map of its functions. It's a map of an alphabetical folder structure. But it's still necessary for me to comprehend it because I need spatial separation to isolate concepts because that's one of the ways I think. And our IDEs just don't do that very well. That was the point, right?
Yeah, because programming has... Once it was on punch cards, but it's always been a linear text-based event to work with it. And the relationships between one block of code and another block of code, depending on how you want to look at those relationships, they're really complex. And I would love a way to visualize that more as I'm working. I mean, we have things like cold code folding and making blocks of code just folded down to a tiny bit. But that's just the very beginnings of some way to organize this incredibly long thousands of lines of code that you have to go through to understand what a program's doing.